All right, we are back. And it's a real pleasure to spend time with this gentleman. In my opinion, he is one of America's great, maybe the greatest, citizen scientist investigator researcher that I've had the pleasure to meet in 15 years of doing this program. He has done more on his own with his own money, time, and resources than anyone I know to research and try to unravel the mystery, now much less so thanks to him and his work, of chemtrails, of examining and identifying various components therein. And lately he's turned his attention to the Morgellons syndrome, affliction, disease, disorder, whatever you want to call it, and has come up with some extraordinary findings. We're not sure, and I know I can speak for Clifford on this, where it's going, but it's going somewhere, and it's damned interesting, if not damned scary. So with that, let's welcome back Clifford Carnicum. Hello, Clifford.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks very much for the invitation to be back and for the very kind words. I appreciate it very much. Well,
my pleasure. Truth is always easy for me.
Yeah.
All right.
You're hanging in there and doing a great job, and I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. We've got some things to talk about, lots of things, and I'm just going to let you kind of, as we usually do, lead the way because you're such a magnificent presenter, so just go at it.
Well, thanks very much, Jeff. I'll try to watch my time. I sent you a list of a few things, and hopefully you got.
I do.
That.
I have
try to monitor
yeah,
my
for our listeners out there, we have an hour and a half with Clifford tonight, so we're going to cover quite a bit of material.
I think how I'd like to start is by simply asking a question. I've been thinking about this for the past couple of days, and I'm not after answering the question at this point. I just want to pose the question to the audience and to have the audience think about this question underneath and underlying all that we're going to speak of tonight. And the question is this: what is it on the planet that we share, that we all share together, really whether we would like it or not, that our whole sustenance and lifeblood and health depends upon? That'll be the main question. And again, I'm not after answering it right now. But then I would also like to propose a scenario. This scenario, as we go along tonight, may not appear very far-fetched. But let us say there was some kind of health condition that was affecting the general population of the planet.
All right.
And then, secondly, let's even be conservative, and let's assume that that condition is not a contagious condition, not something that's going to be spread from person to person, and that this condition has a broad distribution across the planet in a relatively short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would just go back to the original question and have the audience ask, what do we share on this planet, and by what means could such a thing occur? With that being said, I'm going to dig into the central issue, at least that I think is arising whether we like it or not. And this is a question that I think has not been addressed at the level that it needs to be.
Right.
And that is whether or not there is a reasonable basis, that basis hopefully based upon some evidence and scientific observation, but some kind of real basis for it. But is there a basis for linking the aerosol issue, as I call it, popularly referred to as chemtrails, that issue, which has now been in our milieu for over a decade, has affected our planet, and many of us are at a stage where we're, no longer at the questioning and debating stage, but we're trying to come to terms with the physical alteration of the planet that has resulted from it. That issue has matured over the years, and that was certainly the basis of my original work. But is there a basis between connecting the aerosol issue and the Morgellons condition, as it has been called, or even maybe other biological issues?
Mm-hmm.
And I may be incorrect, but I don't think that issue has been addressed properly, because I have seen comments to the effect that, well, we really don't have any evidence, we really don't have much information that would link these two things. And they don't appear to be related. I've even seen it referred to as anecdotal.
Mm-hmm.
And a part of my purpose tonight will be to state, number one, emphatically, that there is a very strong basis, extremely strong basis,
mm-hmm.
for establishing, certainly at the casual level, I can certainly say investigation and research. I can certainly say that. But it may be well beyond that, but emphatically that there is a sufficient basis for establishing a link between the aerosol issue and the biological condition that has manifested itself and has commonly become known as Morgellons. And I'm going to try and establish that basis with you and the audience tonight and where that comes from. And I personally would say that if anybody refers to this history and lineage that we're going to go over as something strictly of an anecdotal nature, that is plain wrong. I would have to question the familiarity of the reader with the body of information that is now available to us and has been available for many years.
Right.
Unfortunately, the more current research is, let's say, solidifying this linkage at a much more serious level. And understandably, we haven't had information at that level up to this time, so we could have some allowance, I think. But to say that there is no relationship, I simply think is a misnomer, and I'll try to be fair in my presentation of why I think that is mistaken. And this issue starts. I'm looking at my paper, and it sort of amazes me sometimes that sort of the volume of information and papers. I don't even recall, directly that I have written some of these papers until I dig back into them and say, oh, yeah. And what happens is, you have the emergence of this aerosol issue on
right.
a broad scale. There are certainly questions that go back to the close of World War II in terms of availability of technology and
right.
And certain levels of application. But
mm-hmm.
on a broad social and planetary level, the beginning of 1999 was a turning point for this issue. And again, I'm not restricting that as a commencement date. But as I look back at the work here, if we accept that starting point of interest, strong interest, being roughly the beginning of 1999, in May of 2000, I put up my first paper on the question of biological components being identified. Now, I didn't do this work. This is sort of the amazing part of this. I wasn't the person that discovered this. I had a medical professional. He chooses to remain anonymous. A very qualified person, certainly in the microscopy world. This individual is aware of this issue emerging, and he's aware of certain airborne environmental samples. And as we go along tonight, I think it's unavoidable. We cannot avoid the connections. The particular airborne sample was that sample which was sent to the EPA for requesting identification.
As to what
it
was.
A lot
well.
Of people, I've harped on this for a decade, so I'm not going to go into all that.
Yeah.
But this is a sample we're talking about. It's an airborne sample.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unusual airborne filament sample
right.
sent to the EPA. They refused to acknowledge it, let alone identify it.
And you got the letter from the EPA, and I posted or linked to it, one or the other. I remember reading it.
It's all on the site, certified mail and the whole bit. That's deeply ingrained in my memory and always will be, and I will never let that go until it's addressed properly. But you have a very qualified medical professional inviting me down to look under the scope. This person has access to some very good gear. I don't have this at all. And this person is telling me that they're seeing biologicals in this airborne sample. And the reason they called me was because I was already posting things simply because of the unusual physical nature of the airborne fibrous material. That enough was sufficient for me to start presenting papers. This individual was looking with sophisticated equipment and was identifying biologicals and wanted me to be aware of that issue. The date on this is May 11th, 2000, is my first paper. We're talking within a first year that you have an independent source say, we've got something going on here more than meets the eye. Let's make it known. It involves biologicals. And specifically, and it already gets very interesting even at this early stage, because, again, I have nothing to do with this. this individual tells me, Clifford, these are red blood cells that I'm seeing in this filament sample. Now, that probably sort of floored me as much as it would anyone when you first hear that statement.
Yep, you bet.
Because I'm thinking, well, first of all, that's impossible. I mean, how does such a thing even happen? You know, there's no, it's not in the body. How could it live? You know, this kind of thing. You got to be kidding. So that was the first stage of this. And this is right at the beginning of the emergence of the so-called aerosol issue.
May 2000, biological components identified, and the EPA's infamous refusal to actually get down and do some research, or at least admit to doing research, and analyze these filament-like items. Pretty disgusting. I remember it clearly. All right, back in just a couple of minutes with Clifford Kernicum. I would invite you to look under Clifford's name at rents.com in guests and click on the Kernicum Institute and check it out. All right, let's get right back to our special guest tonight, Clifford Kernicum. All right, Clifford, May 2000. It's quite an interesting start for this whole thing in a way, but please continue.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. And you know, another observation from this doctor, and by the way, this individual is very, let's say, well-known in his field of expertise. I'm just not at liberty to let his name, you know, but he's very... let's say capable and knowledgeable in his field. This individual
you,
makes
you're,
another
you're,
observation at this
you're
point
understating
that does
it.
Catch my interest. Of course, underneath the surface, I'm buzzing around. How could you possibly have a red blood cell within it, an environmental sample exposed to the air in adverse environmental conditions? And he says these cells appear to be desiccated to me. And in fact, he spent a great deal of time experimenting with methods of attempting to reconstitute this cell. And this is what he noticed. He noticed something small that caught his interest, and he thought it was unusual. I'm sure on his own side he knew that something resembled a red blood cell, but it must have been reduced in size. And he works through trial and error on reconstitution methods, and he does come up with a method that works at that time. It's involving immersion oil. But he clearly states that these cells have been altered in some form. It appears to involve a process of desiccation.
Are we going to use freeze-dried?
I think we're in the same category.
Okay.
The same general category, I think we are.
Right.
So already, from my standpoint, you already have at least a basis. I mean, you have a qualified person that is making his assessment diagnosis as to what's going on here. You have the EPA refusing to identify the very sample that is originating this observation. It's already, we're talking 2000. And this is a sample, this is one of the first samples. It was well known. Okay, there were two or three that were sort of popular at that time, but this one was basically on a roadside. It was huge. It was a half inch thick in terms of the material.
Wow.
So that's my first basis for saying, hey, guys, we may have something to be looking at beyond just physical, environmental, but maybe we have something biological that we need to look at. Now, I get to go through about 3 years of work in 5 minutes because I'm going to run out of time tonight. But if you look ahead now at what happens, this guy was in May of 2000. Mm-hmm. I see that I started in March of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
From March 2001 to May 2004, I wrote six papers. Six papers under which I independently through nothing to do with this person at all, not even seeking it by any means, not even seeking it at all, but certainly seeking, let's say, particulate identification of the atmosphere. That is what I was after.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got involved with this whole period of using HEPA filters, any way I could think of, to try and get things down to submicron level. And so a lot of homebrew stuff, a lot of jury rigging as usual. And I also got into a field called electrostatic precipitation, which is very interesting. It's where you have a high voltage charge in a chamber, and it's just an amazing process where particulates It's used commercially for air cleaning, this type of thing. Mm-hmm. I had two independent methods. Over 4 years, I have five to six papers mm-hmm. basically saying, you know what? I'm not a medical person. I can learn, and I can dig into books, and I'm not a complete neophyte here, but I'm not a medical person. But I'll tell you, as I look at these things, I'm now looking over 3 to 4 years.
Right.
Over and over and over. I don't know how many days or weeks under the scope looking at this. And I'm saying, you know what? I'm seeing things that look just like this individual reported to me mm-hmm. in that fibrous or filament airborne sample.
And you're capturing these, Clifford, in a HEPA filter, essentially in your home.
Not in the home, but outdoor. I was doing all the work outdoors.
There was all right at your home.
Yeah, I locked it in there. I hope it comes back in.
You're there,
but it got pretty weak.
You're there.
But yes, this is all outdoors. You know, I don't have access to top of the world, but I get the stuff in clean as air as I can and up away from the ground as much as I can. I'm running these filters outdoors, and I'm running HEPA filters for weeks on end and mm-hmm. collecting the material. I create this electrostatic precipitation device and collect the material on glass sides. Yeah, it's all outdoors, and the papers are pretty detailed if you look at them. Now, what's weak here at this point of the research is my recording equipment is fairly weak. I don't have much to record it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can see fine detail with the eye. Eye is one of the most acute sensitive devices that there is. So you can see things with your eye, but to get that recorded so that people can see it requires some pretty decent equipment under the microscope. And my equipment was fairly limited at that time, but I started doing the best I could. And I put up these images, and I know that they're not as good as we would like them to be, but the descriptions were detailed. The images are good enough to be able to make the association without any question, again, of erythrocytes or red blood cells. And so it's over and over and over I do this. And I'm saying, you know, this is what I see. Tell me I'm wrong, basically. Look at this. Tell me I'm wrong, but this is what I'm seeing. Do you think I want to get out there and start hollering that I'm finding red blood cells in atmospheric samples? You got to be nuts.
Do you folks understand where this is going and what Clifford has discovered years ago? You're outside and you're breathing fresh air. You may be breathing human desiccated red blood cells, maybe desiccated viruses, maybe all kinds of genetic items put out to test by the Pentagon. The sky's the limit on this, no pun intended. The air is not what it appears to be any longer. We'll be right back with Clifford Chronicle. Okay, welcome back. I'm Jeff Rentsch with Clifford Chronicom, whose nonprofit institute is now open. Please look under Clifford's name and guests and go there and look around. This is a major citizen research victory for all of us, trying to unearth what the government is hiding, and what it is hiding is an awful lot. The air is not clean. The air is probably dangerous, possibly fatal in some cases. We know this from a variety of source materials, not to mention patents and things, and Clifford's work, which towers above so much. Go ahead, Clifford.
Thank you very much, Jeff. You know, these articles that were put up on this subject during that time, they were the source for many attempts at ridiculing my work as,
oh, sure,
well as a character, yeah, assassination.
Yeah. That's right.
They simply were, but you know, what can we say? But we have to pursue that which we know, or at least believe, to be the truth, wherever it comes from and wherever it leads us. And like I say, this is not a subject I wanted to, let's say, be involved in on exposure, you know, but it had to be done because it, uh-huh, was being it was being seen over and
right.
over and over. And this issue of desiccation is a very important part of it, because this is not something like you just go collect a sample and you immediately just see this, you know, perfectly formed cell
sure.
under the scope. There, this reconstitution is a sophisticated transitional phase
mm-hmm.
That is a very significant part of this whole thing we're talking about.
Clifford, over what period of time then, at the beginning of your research with the HEPA filter, when you first began to find these erythrocytes, red blood cells, and other issues as well, how long of a period of time? What were the bookends on this, or are you still ongoing with that kind
of... I was doing my work there. This was just environmental sampling through
mm-hmm,
various
mm-hmm,
methods.
Mm-hmm.
This was going on from March 2001 to May 2004.
Okay, and you found consistent results during that period of time?
Every paper tells... The answer is yes. Every mm-hmm. paper tells what I found, how I mm-hmm. found it, what I did.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, this last one of May 2004 is actually a very interesting paper. And I was deliberately brief on that. I was, because that paper is different. We did talk about it at one point. That paper is called Extraordinary Biological Observations. And I understand it's curt, but the problem was that the ramifications at that time when I saw this, they were so extreme, what it was that was potential. If what I was seeing was true, it just opened up this whole area way beyond the consideration of even the existence of erythrocytes.
Mm-hmm.
But it opened up the issue of, let's say, creation of cells within our bodies through some form of some artificial means, some process where cells were now being created as opposed to, let's say, just being ingested. And that paper, if you look at it, is the first one where there is a culture involved. And what was different here was I was doing the work as normal, collecting these samples, had a lot of problems with the cells becoming deformed because that has to do with osmotic balance, but you have to be in a certain saline concentration for these cells to reconstitute. And that was a long, laborious process to learn that relationship. But there was one time where I had collected through HEPA filters, and I put the samples in a very, very weak saline solution, salt solution.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And this was the first time that I saw these cells reconstitute very evenly and smoothly. It was the first time you had cell destruction during the earlier stages.
Did they exhibit signs of life, Clifford?
Well, you know, the cells are stationary. You know, they red blood cells, and I mean, at least in my slides are dry slides at that point.
Okay.
So there wasn't any kind of, it's not like live blood analysis. They were fixed slides, so there was no motion there of any kind. But in terms of the culture, was there something live involved? Yes, that's exactly what happened.
Uh-huh.
I took the cells which had reconstituted themselves from, you know, collected from a HEPA filter and put them onto a culture medium, an agar medium. And the photographs are there. It's true. I didn't say much, but if you read between the lines, you'll see that I thought it was pretty darn important. And that is, this culture just took off. I mean, in 24 hours, it just exploded. I put one drop, like five parts, you know, five times in the agar dish, and within 24 hours, it just explodes on these drops where I placed them. And then when you put those under the scope, this is where something very unusual happened. And again, it was beyond all reason and consideration at this time. But basically, I saw what were growing cultures of reconstituting erythrocytes, the best that I can identify. If you go through, you'll see I'm always qualifying myself. I'm always saying, it looks like it, feels like it, tastes like it, measures like it.
Yes,
but again, I try to be careful. I'm not saying they are erythrocytes, but I'm saying, you know, the old duck scenario, right? It matches.
Sure. Yep.
The best I can possibly do. But what's different is that is a culture, and these structures are growing, and they're growing massively and radically. And that is wild, because I started asking, are you allowed, are you supposed to be able to grow red blood cells in a test tube? I didn't know at this time, the state of medical knowledge, but I looked and it's like, no way. Sorry, this is like the most sought after advance in medical knowledge, is to be able to develop blood cells outside of the human body. The whole stem cell thing. It's a huge issue. And there is nothing out in the public that said such a thing could be done, let alone with some individual citizen doing work with the means and resources that he has available. But the observations are recorded, and the observations are accurate. And, yes, the description was brief, but if you look closely at that paper, you know, on that bottom line, you will see a reference to my consideration of stem cells, because it's the only thing that makes sense. You have to be dealing something that can create cells out of the human body. So I left it, and I agree it was somewhat cryptic, but it was because it was too big at
now,
that time.
Clifford,
it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough of a basis to clarify it. Further.
Okay, hold. We got a break here. Let me recap this. You were able to, with these desiccated samples, reconstitute them, as it were, and then watch them actually proliferate?
Absolutely.
In a medium.
According to the observation,
right?
And report that I filed, that's exactly
right.
What happened.
Okay, now, that should scare and shake up a lot of you out there. This is not comforting. This is very unnerving kinds of material we're hearing. I will be back with Clifford in a couple minutes to continue. Do look under his name for the newest paper and the Chronicle Institute, which is now up in the stop by, take a look, and we'll be back to continue our talk. All right, back with Clifford Chronicum. Desiccated red blood cells, once reconstituted with moisture and in the proper medium, on the ground, in the air perhaps, in your lungs perhaps, growing. All right, Clifford, let's move ahead. This is pretty amazing stuff.
Thanks, Jeff. And, you know, one of the upshots of this whole thing is we're, myself included, but we have to get over the outlandishness of the idea, the science fiction nature of what it is we're speaking of. We have to get over that emotional reaction that we have when we hear this subject brought up.
Right.
And we have to dig in. We have to confront it, and we have to dig in. And believe me, if it's to be refuted, fine. You'll see I'm writing that over and over. If this is to be refuted, let's refute it. But it's going to be done out in the open in the public, and everybody gets a chance to see the work. There's nothing secret at this point about what needs to be done. Because we're talking about something that has the potential, if not directly affecting the population at large. Now, I see that I'm running 20 minutes behind as usual, so I skip ahead whether I like it or not, and I've got to get to the next stage. And that work starts in 2007, 2008. And looking back, I'm guessing, if we look back at that period from 2004 to 2007, when this next segment starts involving biologicals, I suspect that I was primarily involved with geophysical research at that time, planetary aspects and broad conceptual issues of electromagnetics and this type of thing, is I'm guessing what occupied that block of time primarily from 2004 to 2007. But in 2007, it was right at the beginning of the year, and I'm guessing we talked about this time is my guess, because we briefly made mention of this.
Mm-hmm.
But the subject now, and again, remember our original question that's coming up, is whether or not there is a sufficient basis for linking the aerosol issue and the biological conditions that are existing amongst us. And so there's a period of work, and this involves another half a dozen papers. And this involves an examination of the physical symptoms that are manifesting in those individuals purporting to have this condition called Morgellons condition. And, you know, a breakthrough on my side came. I'd been hearing about the issue for several years under the surface, but the breakthrough came when I had direct access, and that was with the kindness of Jan Smith, who I know you have had on the show and know, but had direct access to a physical sample that this individual provided me, about as direct to the source as I could get. And that's the first time I had anything to look at. And during my work, I'm continually trying to improve my methods and the equipment I have, again, always on a jury-rigging fashion. But I kept trying to improve the microscopy. I'm sort of an optics person anyway, and astronomy and that kind of thing. So I kept trying to do the best I could to try and get these images where people could see what I was seeing. And so by this time, the scope was doing a pretty decent job, actually. And you will find a series of papers starting to examine these physical samples coming out of the skin, the filaments coming out of people's skin, and really under very good detail. I mean, we're talking now, you know, 5,000, 6,000 power under the scope. I had already exceeded the conventional visual scopes at this point.
At what level magnification were you able to see filaments or fibers in, on, or under people's skin, Clifford?
Well, you know, this starts,
I've
what
seen
happens,
them as
Jeff,
low as
is at the,
20.
At the start of it, you can see, you know, these particular samples were visible by eye to start with.
Right.
The raw sample was visible by eye.
In 10 or 20 power, and that's all you need, you can see real clearly.
Yeah, you saw something, you know, which somebody might, you know, try to pass off as a hair, and that's fine. They can try to do that. Mm-hmm. And the business of starting to call them delusion and all this kind of stuff. But
what about,
you know, I'm starting to look under the scope.
Did you have any luck, Clifford, excuse me, with black lights?
I have tried that. There is nothing particularly unique or distinctive. I know there's a lot of claims about that.
Mm-hmm.
I found nothing distinctive of that nature.
Okay.
All my work of distinction is under the scope at the highest power I'm able to round up.
Got it.
That's where everything is happening. And the casual microscopes just don't cut it for any of these things that I'm involved with here. I have the scope now up close to about 10,000 power. I'm sure I've maxed out what I can do with the type of stuff I'm doing. But that makes a huge difference. You know, a regular scope is around about 400. If you do good work with oil immersion, you might get up to 1,000. It's tedious. But to get up at 5 and 10,000, it makes a huge difference. It's where I'm seeing these things. You cannot see them at that lower level, which many people attempt, but you just can't get there. I'm sorry. So I start looking at these samples. And I am going to have to generalize this discussion, but what happens is I start to see parallels. I start to see the same forms showing up over and over and over, and it doesn't matter where they're coming from on the body. In other words, if it's a filament out of the skin, what happens is a filament is just the encasing material. That's not the heart of what we're talking about. It's when you're looking inside of this, okay, that there's this whole network going on, and anytime you think there's one filament, it's literally hundreds of thousands of filaments by the time it's all over. There's no end to it. And that's the part that's being seen. And this is a part that I start seeing parallel crossovers. First of all, it didn't matter what part of the body I was starting to look at. I could look at saliva. I could look at skin. There was a very important sort of discovery. Gwen Scott, naturopathic doctor, gets a great deal of credit. She's the person that, let's say, came up with this method. It's actually been a turning point in the work in terms of providing us with additional samples to look at involving red wine, strangely enough. But red wine was used in the case of severe toothache and extracted a set of filaments, very unusual looking, and that's all recorded too. But filament expulsion from the gums. Well, no matter what I'm looking at, I'm starting to see the same structures. And those papers in detail go over those structures. There's four basic forms. You know, I have to say that the folks that talk about the nanotechnology and the robots and all the artificial stuff, fine, they can talk about it. And maybe it's there. I won't even be surprised if it is there. But if somebody's going to say that, you need to show it. And you first of all need to understand what nanotechnology even means and the equipment that it would take to show that. The stuff that I'm looking at is purely visible, generally of a biological nature, and at the micron range and submicron range. It is not at the nano range. If somebody's telling me there's a robot running around, fine, show me the robot. I'm not saying it's not there, but the work has not been detailed or presented, at least to my satisfaction, that supports a lot of the discussion or conversation that takes place. Again, I won't be surprised if it happens, but I do not see the work properly shown to support the many claims that are being made. I'm talking about direct physical observation of certain forms over and over and over. And I'm not going to go into all those, but there's about four of them in general. You know, you have encasing filaments, you have these submicron internal network. These are at the micron to submicron range. You have what appears to be equivalent, similar to a bacterial form, but extremely small. You know, most bacteria will be from 1 to 10 microns. This guy is about a half, looks like about half of a micron in size. Very hard to see.
Down to viral size.
I push it all that I can. But this shows up over and over and over. There's four forums that I see over and over, and they're very detailed on the site. But it's happening no matter what part of the body and no matter what sample I'm looking at. And now, for the tie-in with our discussion tonight, I go back and I revisit that EPA sample. It's now 3 or 4 years have elapsed. I didn't have the microscopy equipment at that time to do what I was doing, you know, at this stage. And I went back and I said, let's take another look at that filament sample from the EPA that they refused, not from them, but they refused to identify. And if you look at that work, you see an important additional crosslink made. And that is that the structure of that fiber at a filament at an internal nature, at the best that I can do, matches to a T, and the same structures showing up at this level of 5 to 6,000 power between this airborne environmental sample that the EPA refuses to identify and these physical manifestations taking place in individuals so-called with the Morgellons condition. And this is a crucial link to consider.
Got it. Okay, now, people who are listening are saying, all right, Clifford, you're down to half a micron. You're looking way deep into things. Are you spending much time at all with the surface filaments or fibers, the colored ones that we have pictures of, that Jan Smith has taken so many pictures of and put up, and others as well?
I'm not, for several reasons. Okay. Number one, the depth of the issue appears to be contained at the deeper level. You know, we're talking, I'm sure that there is probably a whole world going on, again, like I referred to, beyond what I can see. But
could
I
be,
do want to get to the internal structure as best I can.
Right. Are you tying your work to the colored, classic, easily observable Morgellons fibers?
On a general level, I'm going to say yes, it looks like there is a connection because I see them intermittently. But you know what, I'm careful on that because I'm real careful because I've spent a lot of time looking at filaments and fibers, and there's a lot of confusion about there, and there's a lot of, to me, misinformation. I don't think disinformation, but there's a lot of things that aren't clear that people say. I need the work to be properly documented mm-hmm. before I'll put my name on it. Mm-hmm. And just because I see a colored filament doesn't mm-hmm. mean I attach that level of importance to it mm-hmm. until I know exactly what it is. And I'd have to exhaust that work to find out that answer. I'm just saying my work is focusing in at the very high level of magnification because I'm trying to get to that internal structure,
and
I think it's critical for our knowledge.
Right, right. The things that you're identifying in virtually everyone, do we know that they weren't there 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago? How do we know? Do we, Clifford?
Well, I think that's a great question, you know. Do I know positively? Well, I'd have to find out somebody did the work and said that it wasn't there. I don't know of anybody doing this.
Right.
What I do know is that we have a whole new manifestation of physical things that we can see that I certainly have no record of in the 50s and 60s as I was growing up.
Very good. People in dark field microscopy are saying the same thing. There are a number of people that I know who are in the field. All kinds of things are being observed now that they say are utterly unprecedented. And that's in the human blood. All right, we'll be back. Okay, back with Clifford Carnicum. Have a half hour to go. We're covering some amazing ground. You can see all of it on Clifford's website. Certainly the new Carnicum Institute will house an incredible array of research from Clifford and certainly correlating with others. So go ahead, Clifford. We got a lot to cover here, and we got about 24 minutes to do it.
Yeah, I know it's close. I'll do the best I can. I'm going to take about 5 minutes on this next section and try to save about 15 minutes for the last section.
All right.
But at this point in the chronology of what we have spoken of, there is linkage. There is linkage between the aerosol issue and the Morgellons condition. And that linkage is established through the biological research done over a period at that point of up to 8 to 9 to 10 years, as well as in physical form at the microscopic level between environmental samples and airborne environmental samples and biological specimens that are pervasive.
No
this
question.
Linkage
none,
does
none
exist
whatsoever
at this point.
None.
And it is not anecdotal.
All right. Okay.
Now,
so are we saying then, by extension, that Morgellons is possibly caused by chemtrails or aerosols?
I'm not going to use the word cause, but I'm certainly going to use the word linkage. And when I say linkage, it means a relationship. And it means we need to explore and identify that relationship in detail. And I'm not real big on extending, as you know, my conclusions beyond what they're justified.
No, you're very
conservative. But I'll say it as I did say it, and that is the linkage is sufficient at this point to mean time to do your work. That's what it means. See, I can't come up with the answers until the work is done, and this is a problem I have.
I understand.
That the work's not being done. And I have a real problem with that because the questions are so obvious what need to be answered. And I shouldn't have to speculate. And I shouldn't have to conjecture. And that's one of my difficulties.
Well, you've got a government that's sitting on all kinds of data they won't release. And I obviously don't want to get involved with your research or anybody on this side of the fence. We have a big problem.
That's right. There appears to be a deliberate segregation. Now, the next stage of the work, this is more recent. I see that this is back in July of last year. So now we're talking about in the last 10 months or something like that. And what happens here now is a focus on these dental extraction samples. Because remember, I have equivalence in structure and form between these dental extractions that are taking place through this serendipitous discovery of red wine being used as an extraction method, and those airborne environmental samples. Well, now I have something I can, let's say, produce in a repeatable fashion, and I can put in a more controlled environment. That's an important breakthrough in that sense. And the next part which starts to develop is, to me, an understanding that the perception that this so-called Morgellons condition is restricted to a few individuals that happen to be unlucky and facing skin symptoms appears to be, it seems to be ludicrous. Because when you get into examination of these dental extractions and you start looking at individuals, let's say randomly in the population, I don't know how to say it other than so far not a single person has failed the test. Every single individual that's submitted to this test is producing this material. Now, I'm not saying everybody has it, this dental material, but I am saying that everyone tested so far has. There are varying levels. There does appear to be degrees of presence and formation.
Uh-huh.
But it is occurring across the board, and certainly from a statistical standpoint, it's not unreasonable at all to extrapolate that the statistical norms have been completely breached, and there is a good basis to investigate this on the broad general population as opposed to thinking there are certain hotspots in certain cities.
Right.
That's what the work indicates, that this is a pervasive condition that may well be affecting the general population, I'll say it, and that's a conservative way of stating what I see.
Right.
So I want to focus in on these dental samples because I have something I can work with. And to me, a cultured environment is the next logical step to take. And that is, let's get this stuff in the lab. Don't make it so it's inaccessible. Let's try to get a hold of it. So if a person can culture something, you now have the means to at least have some control over it. And I don't think I'm a control freak, but, it's like the obvious thing to do to me. It's classic lab work. You need to get a handle on what are the conditions of this growth. Can you reproduce it? And so I create a culture of agar, nothing fancy. I'm not sure you actually need any nutrients in it particularly, but it was a bouillon-based agar medium. And I put these dental extractions on that medium. And what happened was I got a growth. It was, things happen through serendipity sometimes. You don't exactly know why. But on that first culture I did, I got this growth showing up within 24 hours. Well, truth is I didn't see that particular growth that I was interested in for another 2 to 3 months. And I still don't know exactly what differences there were and what causes that. But by the time it was over, I did reproduce the growth three different times, so it is repeatable. And what's happening is you have a growth taking place on the dental sample itself. Okay, it looks like the dental material will at least keep its form being through the auger, but it appears as though the dental material itself is the source of the nutrients for this culture, not so much the auger. The culture grows on the dental extraction. And what happens is you get a white filament growth on there. And those papers are all recorded. I'm sure I'll have to speed this up, but they're all there. They're all recorded. And the upshot of this is that those filament structures that grow from this culture are identical in nature to the source material. So the conclusion is that one is able to reproduce the material itself, the dental extraction material itself. By the way, I'm not going to waste too much of our time on it, but the whole idea about, you know, it's just a normal precipitate forming with wine and saliva, I've looked into that. It doesn't cover it. Wine and saliva does form a precipitate. It was actually an interesting experiment I did because I needed to consider that very carefully. But what I'm talking about, and so that's a reality that happens, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a filament form. This is something very physical, not a precipitate at all. It's a filament form. And so now you have a means of culturing something in a controlled way. And that was a breakthrough, and those papers are all on there, and there's time-lapse video imagery I've written, this type of thing. Now, the last segment we have is sort of the stage of seriousness that this work is at now. And it involves an extension of the culture work. And I do regard it as significant. And we can say this happened somewhat accidentally also, but it happened. And that was, I did get involved in about 3 months ago considering a dietary research project and whether or not it might affect the production of these filaments from the gums. I won't go into that particular study. It's incomplete anyway. But that's a side topic of research, effective diet and this type of thing, what affects the production of these materials. Because, like I say, there are differences in degree. There are a couple people that caught my interest that are producing less of this, and I was curious why.
Huh.
Now, this is a part that was serendipitous, I suppose, and maybe partly intuition. But what was unusual here was we had four individuals involved. And we all collected the dental material with the wine, and we concentrated it. We have, you know, quite a pile of the material. Some people get shocked by this when they actually see what's going on. But we collected quite a bit of material, about 9 minutes worth of the wine exposure and collection into a Petri dish. And really, the test was just to examine the amount of material and attempt to relate it to dietary considerations and dietary history. That was the real purpose of it. And normally, any normal human being, I would have just tossed these things. I just wanted to see how much there was coming out, and I would have tossed it. But I didn't. I just did something, I don't know why, but I'm glad that I did, because these samples that I collected from these different individuals that were in the wine, fairly concentrated dental extractions in the wine, I just let them sit. I let the wine and the sample in a Petri dish just sit.
How long?
Okay. In the end, it's a period of roughly 2 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
But I let them sit, and I'd look at them every couple of days, really hadn't the slightest idea of expecting anything or seeing anything. And I'd look day after day, and nothing's going on, but I did just let them sit. And about 2 weeks into it, one of the samples started producing a growth. Now, the one that started producing a growth was from the individual that produced the greatest amount of this dental material during their sampling process. And there was quite a bit, I'll say that. And I was curious about the growth because the growth had the exact same form as the culture growth from before on an auger dish. Now, what's real interesting here is that there's nothing going on here other than wine. There was no auger.
Huh.
Okay?
Odd, very odd.
But time was real important. It wasn't until 2 weeks later that I saw this grow.
Hmm. All right, Clifford, hang on. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We'll have about 6 to 7 minutes when we return. So, again, the Carnicom Institute is there for you. Please do stop by and take a look. Clifford and I will continue after this. Okay, welcome back. Jeff Rentz with Clifford Carnicum. Go ahead, Clifford. Let's roll here and get this through this segment and pack as much into it as we can.
Thanks a whole lot, Jeff. What happens is these cultures take off. They really go to town once they get going. And nothing happened for 2 weeks, but once they started, they really moved.
Did that scare you at all? Was that scary?
It doesn't. You know,
that's not the right word, perhaps, but
it doesn't scare me. In that sense, I'm a person who believes we need to confront whatever it is that faces us in life.
Oh, you always have. I didn't mean scare in the term of contemporary pedestrian fear. I meant intellectually. Was that pretty amazing to see happen?
Yes, at that level, and many times over, actually. Okay, we could talk about being fearful for the human race. Okay.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, certainly at the deeper level, it's extremely, extremely disturbing. Extremely. And, of course, that's why I and others are driven to try to do what we do. But it's hurt. It's very hurtful.
What really bothers me about the entire Morgellons issue are the efforts by various people to call this a skin condition. And forget the fact that it's obviously not just a skin condition, that it is systemic.
Well, you know, my contention is we're going to be learning about this whether we like it or not. This is the way it seems to me. And these things shall pass in one form or another. And to carry on with these cultures then, and I thank you actually, Jeff, for your basically broader an understanding of scope and depth of what it is we're really speaking about here. And what happens with these cultures is they take from 2 to 4 weeks to begin the process. And thus far, the sample is fairly small, but it's getting up to a half dozen or so. So far, everyone produces that culture eventually.
Wow.
Now, the next obvious question that comes up is, hey, maybe it's just normal. I mean, again, you have to... I didn't really know what it was. I just know that, hey, it sure looks identical to what I just did with the auger samples with dental.
Right.
Okay? But what happens is it changes. It goes through a further evolution. This is a change. On the auger, it reaches a certain state, and that's it.
No.
But in this wine medium, it goes through that initial stage, but then it goes through another stage of development. Now, the paper that we're speaking of that this is all based on is called Blood Issues Intensify. It's the most recent paper.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a lot of photographs on that paper, and I think I would encourage people to go there as we run out of time tonight. But the next question that comes up, is it normal? And so I spend a lot of time, as usual, under the scope. I'm trying to make it normal. I'm always trying to make it normal. So you've got to learn about other forms that might look like this. You know, when I get into yeast, I spend a lot of time seriously entertaining the idea whether or not there's yeast cells. There's what's called a dimorphic form where you have both a filament and a circular structure, which has some similarities to what I was seeing on the surface. And I tried real hard to make this some kind of yeast growth. But there's problems that come up, too, in that wine, doesn't seem real logical. And I look into it, and indeed it wasn't real logical, that you have something growing in a wine base. An alcohol base is not considered to normally be a very optimum environment for growing any kind of mold or pathogen forms. I wouldn't believe, and my research indicates that's exactly the case. But I try to make it normal, and what happens is something else I'm seeing shows up. What happens is I have this filament structure showing up again, but I'm starting to see these circular structures in there. And these circular structures start to catch my attention, because what's happening is under the scope, it's not happening until about 20 to 40 minutes under the scope, but as the session is going along, I'm noticing these circular structures are changing in form very slowly. But they're evolving. And what are they evolving into? They're evolving into something, that looks exactly like all these other issues we've been talking about for 10 years.
Uh-oh.
They look like an erythrocyte, a red blood cell, but not immediately.
Mm-hmm.
It's taking 20 to 40 minutes. And the impression I have at this point is that I have a partial reconstitution within the wine, but there's something about the light and heat of the microscope stage and time that was causing a continued evolution of the forms. And the photographs are up there, but on a visual level, I'm coming to the determination again and again and again. It looks like I'm right back where I was, But now I'm back tying in with that article called Extraordinary Biological Observations that we spoke about, because now I have this massive kind of growth that's taking place. Okay?
Uh-oh.
So this is the huge sort of issue that comes out of this. Now, what I have to do at this point is I say, now we're at the point where, you know, the image is not enough. We have to do our best to find out if this is actually blood, because it's an incredible claim. There's no way that we would expect this in our environment. So I work real hard to try and come up with certain chemical tests to go beyond the visual stage, which is already at an unusual level because we're up to 8 to 10,000. You just don't get that opportunity very often. And I've got a match. But I question, can I come up with some chemical tests to determine if this is blood, the best that I can do within my means? And there are a couple of forensic tests. It took me a long time to come up with this. Chemicals are not all that easy to come up with right away. You don't just find them on the street. But there are two forensic tests that are out there. One's called Castle-Meyer test, and the other one is called Hemostix, which is a commercial product. These are forensic tests. These are tests that would be suitable for the court level. They're what they're called presumptive blood tests, meaning that if they pass these tests, it's certainly good enough to get in the courtroom. From here on, you have to get into a more sophisticated lab presence to make that final determination. But presumptive blood tests are considered very serious business in the legal world. And I subject these cultures to these forensic tests, both of them, and they both pass the test. They both pass the test. There are three methods by which the presence of erythrocytes and a hemoglobin are being confirmed in this cultured growth. And this is the end of the research as it stands right now.
Amazing and alarming, to put it mildly. Clifford, you'll come back on again soon, I hope, and we'll carry on our conversation.
I'll always do my best, Jeff, and I thank you very much for having me and for everything that you've done.
My pleasure, sir. Good night.
Bye-bye, Jeff.